Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Graduate Council of the Academic Senate, it's my very great pleasure to welcome you today to the first of two Hitchcock lectures to be given by Sir Peter Hall. The Hitchcock Professorship is one of the earliest and most cherished endowments at the University of California at Berkeley. It was developed from a bequest of property made in 1885 by Dr. Charles M. Hitchcock, a San Francisco physician with an extensive interest in education. The intention of his bequest was to establish a professorship at the University of California for the purpose of giving free lectures on scientific and practical subjects. In 1930, Dr. Hitchcock's daughter, Lily Hitchcock Coit, contributed additional funds to the memory of her father and mother. She was, during her lifetime, considered to be one of San Francisco's most colorful figures. Her generous bequest greatly expanded her father's original gift, making it possible for the university to liberalize the terms of the professorship and to present a series of Hitchcock professors. The great extent to which this endowment has enabled the university community to become closely acquainted with distinguished scholars from throughout the academic world is demonstrated by the list in your programs of those who have served as Hitchcock lecturers and Hitchcock professors. The university is proud to see the tradition of the Hitchcock professorship so eminently upheld by Sir Peter Hall. Sir Peter Hall is the most prominent urban scholar, planner, and geographer in the United Kingdom. He has made countless contributions in the field of planning and development and is considered the father of the industrial enterprise zone, adopted by countries worldwide to develop industry in disadvantaged areas. In addition to his many memberships on government and international committees, he has served as a planning and development consultant to various government agencies and departments. Most notably, he has acted in the capacity of governor for the Center for Environmental Studies and as a special advisor on strategic planning to the Secretary of State for the Environment. Among his many awards, he was presented the Founders Medal by the Royal Geographical Society, and he was knighted in 1998. Sir Peter is currently the chair of planning at the Bartlett School of Planning at University College London, and Professor Emeritus of City and Regional Planning here at UC Berkeley. He taught at Berkeley between 1980 and 1992 and was a director of our Institute of Urban and Regional Development from 1989 to 1992. We are especially delighted to welcome him home. He has authored and edited nearly 30 books in the last 35 years and continues to educate and enlighten his audiences today. One of his most recent books, Cities and Civilization, explores 21 cities at their greatest moments in history and explores the question, why in the past 2,500 years have certain cities in the West experienced a golden age? Suggesting that the answer lies in a collective ingenuity and innovation born out of the need for human survival and comfort, Peter's remarkable work endeavors to analyze and explain the city as the birthplace of Western civilization. In his lecture today, entitled Cities and Civilization, Culture, Innovation, and Urban Order, Peter summarizes the main conclusions of his recent book on urban creativity and its contribution to the golden ages of great cities. He contends that two kinds of creativity, artistic and technological, have begun to converge in the 20th century and will continue to do so in the 21st. He will argue that this is a distinctively American and especially a Californian phenomenon. Without further delay, I'm pleased to present to you Sir Peter Hall.
I'm hopeful that it will be better just as soon as I've adjusted this microphone. Is that any better?
Yes.
You're hearing good. First of all, let me say that it truly is a great honor to be invited by the Berkeley campus to come and give these two lectures. It's a great honor, and it's also an enormous pleasure. Because as Joe has said, for me and for Margaret is a homecoming. I very truly feel that although a Londoner born and bred and returned to my native city, I very much have allegiance to another geographical and academic home here in Berkeley. And it's, for me, a very moving and wonderful occasion to come and be able to give these two lectures on cities in civilization. Now, the question I would like to explore with you today is one that's been very much concerning me over a period of years. And indeed, it is summed up by this picture, which I hope is going to come onto the screen any moment. Have we got a small problem up there? I think we have a problem with the slides up at this end. So they're coming. Good, thank you. This picture is called A Golden Age. It hangs in the Alte Pinakothek in Munich, and it was painted, as I'm sure many of you will recognize immediately, by Lucius Cranach the Elder. It was painted in a small East German city called Wittenberg on the Elbe, a small city, but one that saw a remarkable burst of creativity at the beginning of the 16th century. Not merely artistic, because Cranach's great friend was Martin Luther, and it was here that Luther nailed the famous theses to the doors of the cathedral to usher in the Reformation only a few years after Cranach painted this picture. And so they were living in a city enjoying a golden age, and those golden ages, those Belle Epoque, occurred to cities rather larger and better known. And we have to ask, why was Florence so remarkable a place in the 15th century, or London in the 16th, or Paris at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century? How exactly do these golden ages come about, and why is it that they generally don't last more than a few decades at a time? Why do so few cities have more than one such golden age, although sometimes they manage that trick? How is it, therefore, that many cities fail to recapture this special creative spark that once set them alight? And how do some cities very occasionally do it twice or more? Now, I have to warn you that the hard part is that on reflection, I'm not entirely sure I've got a satisfactory answer. I think in any work like this one, you're reminded of the Reverend Casaubon in George Eliot's novel Middlemarch, who labored, as you may recall, to produce the key to all mythologies and ended up with nothing except a set of card indexes. Maybe all those who try to write history suffer from a similar syndrome, and I was rather amused to find that in the letters of A.J.P. Taylor's widow that he had similar moments of doubt and also compared himself to the Reverend Casaubon. However, whether I've succeeded or failed, I want to argue that it is an important question. It's an important question because practical people do now believe, in fact, they seem to be obsessed by the question of what we call cultural industries, a term that I think would have seemed silly or even a little vulgar 20 years ago. And I think that it's interesting that John Maynard Keynes, some 70 years ago, and one must remember that Keynes made the famous remark that practical people are the slaves of some defunct economist. Keynes, in an essay in 1930, predicted that eventually the world might reach a position where we no longer needed to care about the basic economic problem of survival, but were at last able to do only the things we found agreeable. And he wrote, and I find this passage unforgettable, he wrote, thus, for the first time since its creation, man will be faced with his real, his permanent problem, how to use his freedom from pressing economic cares, how to occupy the leisure which science and compound interest have won for him, to live wisely and agreeably and well. And he went on to describe a world in which, as he said, we would take least thought for the morrow. We shall once again more value ends above means and prefer the good to the useful. We shall honour those, he said, who can teach us to pluck the hour and the day virtuously and well, the delightful people who are capable of taking direct enjoyment in things, the lilies of the field who toil not, neither do they spin. And he did warn that it would take some years to come through what he called the tunnel of economic necessity into daylight. I think we can argue that in the intervening 70 years, something rather remarkable has happened. We have come in the advanced countries of the world, in the United States and the United Kingdom and most of the countries of Europe, we have come out of that tunnel of economic necessity into daylight, in that most of us can now guarantee the resources necessary for almost all of us to live at least a decent minimum of existence. But the really interesting point is that something that Keynes himself could never have guessed at, and that is that these agreeable activities have become sources of income, sources of economic growth, generating these new cultural of industries of a kind never known to earlier or simpler eras. Rich, affluent, cultivated nations, and above all the cities of those nations, can sell their beauty, their philosophy, their art, their theatre, their music to the world. Very rapidly we have passed from a manufacturing economy to an informational economy, more recently still, to a cultural economy. Cities across the world are now more and more preoccupied by the idea that cultural industries have become the means of economic regeneration. Consider what's been happening in European cities like Bilbao, like Barcelona, Montpellier and Nîmes in southern France. They are, as well as old industrial cities like Glasgow, they are all in this same business. Culture, it seems, will fill the gap, well, hopefully will fill the gap left by all the lost factories and warehouses, sometimes occupying those lost factories and warehouses in London. In a month's time, we open the taped modern gallery in an old power station opposite St. Paul's Cathedral on the other side of the Thames. And so in this way, we will create a new urban image which in turn will make cities more attractive to mobile capital and mobile professional workers. Now, I want to talk especially and for a few minutes about that kind of creativity. But it isn't the only kind of creativity, and I want to talk about other kinds too. I want to argue, in fact, that there are, four or perhaps three and a half kinds of creativity. There is the basic cultural and intellectual creativity I've just been speaking about and that Keynes was speaking about. There is a different kind which is technological and productive, and there is an interesting marriage between those two, the marriage of art and technology, which is, as Joe Cerny said in his introduction, particularly American, at least so far. And there is finally a kind of technological organizational creativity that consists in cities solving their own problems. And one can say that in the last 200 years, the second and the third and the fourth kinds of creativity have become progressively more important, and indeed the in the last century that's just passing, the marriage of art and technology has been particularly a development which is likely also, I will argue, to be the definitive form of economic growth in the first half of the 21st century. So, against that background, back to the beginning and back to the fundamentally important question of cultural innovation. I'm going to look very briefly, or too briefly, skipping over several hundred pages of the book, at six case studies ranging from Athens 500 BC to Berlin in the 1920s to try to ask what are the main features which these cities display individually and what are the main general conclusions that you can draw. Before we come back to those general conclusions, which are summarised here, let me walk you very quickly through some of the six individual case studies. The Athens of Pericles in the 5th century BC was not a sudden event, but was the culmination of a long process. And most of the obvious explanations won't exactly do. There was affluence. Athens was a very affluent city by the standards of the then world, but not by ours, but so were ancient Egypt and Babylon before it. Better is the notion that the Greeks developed, as we all know, a unique culture, a culture based partly on philosophy, philosophy of Socrates and of Plato, partly on art in the development of the first naturalistic art from the more formal archaic forms, and then culminating finally in the art going into the buildings. But there was more than this, because these advances were bound up with the development of direct democracy and with free intellectual inquiry and an independent legal system, and indeed the agora beneath the Parthenon was the place where the democracy had its free play of the whole free people. All part of the same culture. But this still leaves the questions, how and why? The best explanation seems to be that other places had the same ingredients, but Athens had more of them in a richer mix. It had more trade, more mixing of people and cultures, both from the originally more cultivated eastern end of the Mediterranean and the originally less cultivated northern side. It was more of a trading empire. It was, in fact, one of the first great trading empires of the world, and it had a supply of slaves to do the hard work, the anomalous feature of that great civilization, as well as a very important group indeed, the non-citizens, you might call them the green card holders, who in fact ran the economy and provided a disproportionate part of the artistic and philosophical talent that made Athens what it was. And that, by the way, is a point that will recur. But not only that, Athens became creative at a special point, a point of transition from a static, conservative, aristocratic society to an open, urban, commercial one. And the combination, the clash of these two sets of qualities proved uniquely valuable. And we shall see this clash again and the final mixture of the two streams in Elizabethan London or 19th century Paris or Berlin in the 20s. The tension between the two sets of values, between an old religiously ordained order and a new humanly decreed freedom, this proved almost too much to bear. And finally, all too quickly, this golden age faded out after rather less than a century to disintegrate into a form of dictatorship. So come forward now to Florence, 2,000 years on, between 1400 and 1420. This was the richest area in Europe, and Florence was the richest city in Italy. And we find here, very interestingly, an early capitalist economic revolution. Not a revolution in industry, that came later, of course, but a revolution in economic organization and in finance, a well-developed banking system and accountancy system. And this produced an explosion of wealth and concentrated it in a new upper-class bourgeoisie, which intermarried with an older landed aristocracy and established a city-state with a limited property-based democracy. Shades of Athens. Yet, although some of the relationships of Florence were continental, you could even call it one of the first global cities, the basic unit of production remained the craft workshop. And the craft workshops made wonderful goods, such as woolen goods, but they also produced the arts. This was a craft economy. Likewise, Florentines' notions about psychology and their worldview remained part medieval. You see this transition in the art, you see it in the famous baptistry doors, you see it in the paintings, that there was a gradual transition from religious themes reflecting the old world order of the High Middle Ages, but progressively discovering classical humanism. This then was a city just starting the long transition into the modern age. A really radical change in consciousness occurred. People, for the first time, you can recognize them as modern people, conscious of being in charge of their own lives. And it's much more likely to have happened here than any other Italian city because of the power of the great bourgeois patrons like the Medicis, because these patrons had the surplus wealth to commission the art, because they also were the class that ran the city, and the city collectively commissioned art, and because these people embodied in themselves this transition between the old medieval past and the new modern humanism. So that then was very briefly the story of Florence. Come on now another 100 and more years, 150 years to London in Shakespeare's time. Striking parallels here with Florence. Here too an early capitalist transformation based on new trade and new forms of organization. London was the great global city of the late 16th century. Here too a multiplication of wealth, new habits of conspicuous consumption. Here too new wealth concentrated into the hands of a trader class. You can see some of them at the bottom of this, map, and of a speculative aristocracy that clustered around the royal court at Westminster on the left-hand side of the map. And here, these people, particularly the court, provided patronage and protection for the artists, now the theatrical artists. These artists saw themselves as popular entertainers. This was the Hollywood of its day, but they were people of wide culture and wit. True, London also shows differences from Florence. Here the capitalists are only occasionally promoters. More often they were Puritan backwoodsmen opposed to the theatres. The artists were no longer guild craftsmen but were true capitalist entrepreneurs. They were sharers, they were shareholders, venture capitalists if you like, in the new art forms. Art was a commodity. You paid at the box office to enter those theatres, the Globe and the Rose, that you see along the south bank of the Thames, where the Tate Modern is now just about to open next door to the reconstructed Globe. But the similarities are more striking. Both London and Florence were societies in the throes of transition from the medieval order to the modern order, and their artistic achievement reflects the tensions of freedom versus that old order, as we can see in the whole of the Shakespeare canon. this kind of tension flourishes in a special kind of city, one at the economic forefront that consequently draws in talents, that's prepared to try new kinds of social relationships and new intellectual concepts. The theatres then, like this one, which you can again revisit if you come to London and see the reconstructed Globe, were created by true capitalists like Edward Alleyne on the right-hand side, who were the patrons who essentially provided the backing for artists like Shakespeare and Ben Jonson. Come forward again to Vienna, and here the Golden Age was longer and it had more dimensions. It lasted from around 1750 to beyond 1900, over a century. It consisted essentially of two great bouts of creativity. The first, almost exclusively musical, around 1780 to 1825. The second, peaking around 1900, also artistic, literary, cultural, and scientific. The first was the creation of a landed aristocratic society around the court. The second was the creation of a mainly industrial bourgeois society embracing new cultural elements, above all Jewish immigrants from the eastern parts of the then Austro-Hungarian Empire, who constituted a quite disproportionate part of the Viennese intelligentsia around 1900. But in the course of this long revolution, which was a revolution in the theatres and the concert halls, especially along the great Vienna Ring, which was built in the 1850s by Franz Joseph in the early parts of his reign, and gave rise to this aristocratic and bourgeois society, which is so well illustrated in this painting. In the course of this revolution, Austria and Vienna managed to absorb change so that court and aristocracy continued overwhelmingly to set the framework of society and culture, but becoming by 1900 a kind of restraint on artistic forms, seen as corrupt, tired, basically an order on the wane, as indeed it was, because it lasted only a few years, as did the Austro-Hungarian Empire itself. And the extraordinary tone of that society, light, superficial, somewhat insincere, cynic, yet cynical, yet extremely witty, accomplished, above all charming, the quality seen in this painting, this was part of the essence of the creative ability. It was a very light society, I suppose epitomized by the waltz, which was its most striking popular art form. Coupled with the influence of Italy coming across the Alps, because the northern part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, until the loss of Venice in 1859, coupled with the influence of the Counter-Reformation, it created a very special mix with which no other city could remotely compete. And it culminated in the extraordinary burst of creativity represented by painters such as Klimt, but also by the intellectual activity represented by thinkers such as Hofmannsthal, and also, of course, Sigmund Freud. And we can sometimes be astonished by the fact that this society was a quite small society in which almost everyone among these figures knew everyone else quite intimately. On now to Paris at the same period, the Parisian Golden Age, which happened between around 1865 and 1910, was, as everyone knows, almost exclusively in the visual arts, but with increasing links to the literary avant-garde around 1900. That was totally unsurprising because the visual arts had always had a special home here since the 17th century as a result of state patronage. But from around 1860 onwards, the arts came into a complex relationship with another and even grander state project, which was Napoleon III's attempt to use the state as an engine of capitalist modernization. This led to rapid economic growth, later true than in the United Kingdom, but producing new wealth in new hands, new class relationships. The visual arts became a commodity traded in the market through dealers and supported by critics who became enormously influential because their word would sell pictures or fail to sell them. Paris logically became the European centre for this new market because it was to art as Manchester was to cotton textiles. What then happened from around 1865, 1870 onwards was another revolt of the generations against the academy structures, against the Beaux-Arts structures, and in the process a revolution that was both technological and conceptual. The young artists formed networks wherever they met, and these networks, as they always do, served as conduits for further innovation. The Impressionists were followed by the Post-Impressionists and were followed by the extraordinary band of young artists, including Picasso at the turn of the century, who met in Montmartre in the Lapin Agile, the famous cafe, and where new modes of painting, of a departure from representation were worked out by the young Picasso, himself of course an émigré from Barcelona, and culminating in the Demoiselle d'Avignon of 1907, the definitive break with representation. Now the point about this break is that it could only have occurred in Paris, because only in Paris was there an artistic establishment to react against, and this provided some kind of tension between an old order, a conservative order, and a new order, against which for something like 40 years young rising painters made their advances from Manet and Monet through Cézanne, through Van Gogh, and finally to Picasso and his contemporaries. Come forward again now to Berlin in the 1920s. An extraordinary creative milieu in so many fields, from theatre to painting, from cinema to opera. And the reasons, again, to do with profound, even cataclysmic change. Berlin, in the 30 years before 1914, had become the first city of the first economic power of Europe. Advanced technology and high-quality scientific innovation had generated new industries, new wealth. But then in a few months in 1918, 1919, came the catastrophe of defeat, the end of the monarchy, as in Austria, and an abortive socialist revolution, followed by 5 years of chaos and the great inflation of 1923, in which many of the middle class lost almost everything. Traditional values were shaken more fundamentally than anywhere else in the world, apart from the Soviet Union, with which the Berlin artistic fraternity had such close relations. And so in the theater of Brecht and Weill and Piscator, in the art of Georg Grosz, the themes were very explicitly political. They were left-wing, hence the close links with the early Soviet Union, but highly innovative. Huge departures from the conventional structure of theatre made by Piscator and Brecht in those productions of the mid-20s, the equally striking advances in the cinema, which were closely interrelated. The achievement reflecting the collapse in values. In so many ways, the city rejected its past and looked to the future. There was a cynical belief here too, as earlier in Vienna, that everything was illusory. Berlin was seen as the archetypal modern city. Yet, as I said, this was the most explicitly political art the world had seen. So come what may, the situation was unstable, and this was the shortest golden age of all. Either the communists would take total power, or the Nazis would seize power, and of course the Nazis finally won in the power struggle of 1933. The irony was that after the fall of the Nazi regime in 1945, most of the city was taken over by the communist regime that maintained Brecht in his theater on the Schiffbauer Dam as a kind of symbol, but actually shut down most of the, what artistic innovation was left. And so for very many years, Berlin remained a kind of doom city, celebrating a lost past. So a rather remarkable and a sad story, but during those few years, producing extraordinary advances which still survive to us in almost any modern theatrical production and in the movies such as Metropolis, which in a way was a celebration of the qualities of that huge industrial and somewhat inhuman city in its heyday. So, trying to sum up, what conclusions could we reach about what these places had in common? Well, rather a huge attempt at generalization. There isn't very much relevant theory I found in the literature. The Marxists, who should be good at this kind of thing, didn't seem to do very much. The psychologists, who might have been interesting because they've written a great deal on creativity, thousands and thousands of pieces, deal with the phenomenon as an individual, not a social phenomenon. But I think you can find interesting clues in from one or two odd sources. In the 19th century, an art critic called Hippolyte Taine, a professor at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, the one that was so reviled by the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists, in 1865 he published a philosophy of art, the Philosophie d'Art. And in it he developed the idea of an artistic milieu which would prevail in one city or another. And he actually used the same cases as I've used ancient Greece and 15th century Italy, as well as the Netherlands in the 16th and 18th centuries. He used for these places a very odd word. He used the word race. He didn't mean what you and I think by race, but a rather a set of characteristics that a people acquired from long residence in a particular place, a kind of accumulated culture and style of life. And I think the nearest parallel is with Thomas Kuhn's well-known notion of paradigm shift. There was a kind of prevailing paradigm or set of paradigms of an artistic character which was pervasive in these places for some years. The other place where I found useful theory, oddly enough, was in Sweden and from the geographers. In the geography department at the University of Lund in Sweden in 1978, the geographer Gunnar Törnqvist developed the notion of a creative milieu. And he said that it had four key features. Number one, information transmitted among people. Number two, knowledge, the storage of this information in memories, real or artificial. Number three, competence in certain relevant activities. And finally, number four, creativity, the creation of something new out of these activities. And he argued that certain kinds of competence, certain kinds of human competence, could be attracted at certain times to certain magnetic places. Consider Vienna in that 19th century period, which was again a case he quoted. Such places needed communication, he said, between individuals and between different areas of competence. So they demanded a density of communication. And so you got this communication, particularly in a dense, traditional kind of city, such as traditional European cities. Now, he further went on to say that such a creative milieu was very chaotic. It was unstable. And he used a metaphor. He said it was like a river that entered a period of instability in its middle course, where you weren't quite sure where it was going to run and where it often divided into what geomorphologists call a braided stream. And it's very interesting that another Swedish scholar, Åke Andersson, has developed a very similar context and has used a concept and has used the same metaphor of a river. And in his work, which is, by the way, only in Swedish, he lists six characteristics of a creative milieu: a sound financial basis, basic original knowledge and competence, that word competence again, an imbalance between an experienced need and actual opportunities, this is this tension that I've spoken of, a diverse milieu, good internal and external possibilities for personal communication. And finally, this structural instability. He quotes one rather interesting instance. In fact, a couple of instances that I'll quote to you. One is borrowed from Arthur Koestler's book, The Act of Creation. Koestler mentions the invention by Gutenberg of the printing press. The printing press demanded an association between three different technologies: woodblock engraving, phenomenon of raised letters, which you already got in coins, and the wine press. And Koestler describes the breakthrough where Gutenberg attended a wine festival and realized that the press could be used to press type in the form of a woodblock engraving. But Koestler didn't mention, and Andersson doesn't mention, that the breakthrough came because the region around Gutenberg's city, the city of Mainz in Germany, was and is one of Germany's major wine-growing areas. If Gutenberg hadn't seen a wine press, the idea would never have come to him. The other case that Koestler mentions was the Wright brothers' invention of powered flight and their realization that structural instability was the clue to powered flight. And it's not fanciful to think that, as many of you will know, the Wright brothers were bicycle manufacturers before they got into flying. The key was the ability to transfer an idea from one circuit of the brain to another. So, do these ideas help explain the cases? Well, as we've seen, these were very different cities. They were generally, though, among the bigger and more important places of their particular times. They were generally quite unpleasant places, at least by our standards. Even their rich people lived really quite squalid lives compared with the very average family in the United States or Europe today. But what was important was that rapid social and economic transformation. Particularly the transformation into a capitalist city. Athens, of course, wasn't a capitalist city, but it was a trading city. The others were all capitalist cities with some pre-capitalist features, but all were great trading cities. And or out of trade came new ways of economic organization, new forms of production, and above all, these cities were very much at the centers of their respective territories, whether their territories were the leading territories or perhaps the second or third rank places of their times. The wealth was very important. Athens was not a rich place by our standards, but its citizens had very modest personal needs, and so there was collective wealth to spare. The other cities we've seen were by far the wealthiest places in their domains. And so perhaps it's true that, as D.H. Lawrence once said, memorably, culture was founded on the deep dung of cash. That meant individual patronage, but also communal patronage coming from the local city or sometimes later on the nation state. The role of the community was always important in the bigger artworks because they cost serious money. They were high culture cities in which art was the province of a minority. Athens was perhaps the last such city where most citizens were actively involved, not only in politics, but also in experiencing art. Art had a bourgeois clientele, and that meant an unequal distribution of wealth in order to provide the surplus. But, of course, that was not enough. That was on the demand side, as the economists would say, and there had to be a supply side. The talent was equally important, and a notable feature is that the talent was very often in the form of recent in-migrants, sometimes from the countryside around the city, often from far distant places. Those metics in ancient Athens I've mentioned, the artists who came into Florence from the countryside, the provincial musicians of Vienna, the provincial artists of Paris, the Jewish intelligentsia of fin de siècle Vienna. The creative cities were cosmopolitan, they drew talent from the far corners of the empires, and the clientele were often drawn from the same group as the talented artists. But these talented people needed something to react to, and we saw that these were transitional cities. Because of this, they were transitional in social relationship, in their values, in their views about the world. They were in a state of tension, often unstable tension, between these conservative forces, aristocratic, hierarchical, religious, conformist, and a set of radical values which were the exact opposite, bourgeois, open, rational, skeptical. In the book I say, and I quote, "These were societies troubled about themselves, societies in that were in the course of losing the old certainties, but deeply concerned about what was happening to them," end of quote. It was more complicated than just capitalism versus feudalism. In the 19th century, the bourgeoisie, or a part of the bourgeoisie, might become a brake on the development of new artistic forms, as you can see in Paris. It might take a complete near revolution, a total breakdown of the established order, to generate the creative spark. What is crucial is that the disjuncture is experienced by a group of creative people who feel themselves outsiders, or rather they both belong and they do not belong, either because they're young, people like Picasso in Paris in 1900, or because they're provincial or even foreign, Picasso again, or because they don't belong to the established order of power and prestige. They might be rich, they might be connected to society, they might be very connected to society, but they felt themselves partly outsiders. Great art is not produced, is not patronized by true insiders who feel comfortable with themselves. So there must be a state of ambivalence. People must feel themselves neither completely excluded nor so warmly embraced that the creative drive is lost. And then this group must communicate avant-garde notions to a class, often the same class, that patronizes them and provides the necessary support for the artists. Look at the Athenians, who heeded the doctrines of the sophists and the playwrights who followed them. Look at the Florentine bourgeoisie, who commissioned the new naturalist art, and finally had the temerity to put themselves in the pictures they commissioned. That would have been blasphemous a century earlier, because they were often religious themes. Look at the Elizabethan playgoers in the galleries at the Globe or in the royal playhouses. Look at the Viennese concert goers. Look at the Parisian bourgeoisie, who bought the Impressionists and later bought Picasso. And look to the Berlin bourgeoisie, who flocked to the Theater am Schiffbauer Damm to hear their very values parodied and attacked. So these places were quintessentially uncomfortable and unstable. And that is the argument that I try to put over in the section of the book, the long section on the artistic city. There is a question I put at the end. Is it purely a matter of socio-economic forces, Marxist analysis style, or is there something which is independent for culture? I find it very difficult to draw a conclusion on this. I feel that there is very much a set of strong contingent circumstances, as I've argued to you, but these are a necessary and not a sufficient condition. Similar circumstances occurred in other cities without the creative spark taking over. So there is an element which is unique in all this, and it's the uniqueness that makes for the interest of these places. I'd like to talk longer about these matters, but time presses on, and I'd like to come on now to the second and very different kind of innovation, technological innovation. Again here, I look in the book at some six cities, spanning a shorter time from 1770 to around the 1990s, but they're very different cities. They were not, for the most part, established cities. They were not the great central cities of their time. One exception, 20th century Tokyo. They were cities somewhat on the periphery of the then established world when they made their mark. They were neither right at the center of that world, as the culturally innovative cities generally were, nor were they right at the periphery of their world. They were middling cities. They were plugged into what was happening in the world, but keeping their distance. They were emerging, upstart places. Places like Manchester at the end of the 18th century through to Tokyo at the end. So what kinds of conclusions can we draw here? Well, let's go very quickly through the cases. Let's look at Manchester at the time of the First Industrial Revolution, with the amazing chain of innovation that started with the spinning jenny in the 1760s and culminated in Robert's self-acting mule, one of the first pieces of automatic machinery in 1828. These inventions appropriated, sometimes truly appropriated, by entrepreneurs like Thomas Arkwright, who actually started life in the outskirts of Manchester at Preston, but later moved to the Midlands. Then go on to look at Glasgow in the 1830s and 1840s with the development of the steamship and its gradual conquest of the oceans with the first Cunarders, application of the steam engine, James Watt's famous walk across Glasgow Green in 1765, and the application of that steam engine not only to industry but to steamships, creating in Glasgow the greatest shipbuilding industry of the world by the end of the 19th century. Now, alas, almost completely disappeared. That's a picture of a Cunarder under construction around 1895. To look at Berlin between 1840 and 1880s, when it became the Silicon Valley of its day, Electropolis, as it's been called in one German book, the creation of great entrepreneurs like Werner von Siemens and Emil Rathenau, founder of AEG, and the
great industrial complex which Siemens built and became Siemens City, Siemens Stadt, and then go on to Detroit in 1900, to Henry Ford and the Model T, and the development of the assembly line, first on the celebrated Magneto line in 1913 at Highland Park in Detroit, and that permitting the production of the Model T, the application of mass production to automobility. Go on to look at beyond that at the total integration of production in the Rouge plant that followed Highland Park in Detroit. And then go on to look at a much more familiar story, the development of electronics, first of all in the Stanford campus, particularly either side of World War II, through Frederick Terman, the professor and then dean of electrical engineering. The invention of the transistor and of solid-state technology by the celebrated trio of Shockley, Bardeen and Brattain at Bell Labs in New York in 1947, and its translation into California in the 1950s. On through the development of the personal computer, originally not here but in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1975, but then carried to a crescendo in the homebrew club that met both in Stanford and here in Berkeley in the late 1970s, and culminating in the first really successful personal computer, the Apples 1 and 2 by Jobs and Wozniak in around 1977-1978, followed by the IBM PC in 1981. And then the development of the electrical and electronics industry in Tokyo, surviving the earthquake of 1923, and producing a new form of innovation in electronics, which rested less on individual entrepreneurship, individual innovation, than on team innovation carried through in vast companies where the innovation was internalized in giant laboratories and then carried into very rapidly into mass production, as in this Toshiba television factory circa around 1970. Now, what lessons do we learn from these six case studies, which I've gone through so quickly out of necessity? You might say very difficult to generalize, but I think the Japanese example apart, these studies seem to show the continuing strength of what I'll call bottom-up individualistic innovation. The innovators from Manchester onwards were outsiders living in outsider cities. Most of these innovators were middle class, although some of the early ones had relatively little education. They were at least well-grounded in basic technical skills. They had to be. And a surprising number early on were self-taught. Well, again, they had to be because there was no one to teach them. All followed careers that taught them what they needed to know in some related industry or field. They were well-grounded. Their successes were no accident. They all relied on strong local networks, which supplied specialist skilled labor and services, and which created a climate of innovation among many small firms sharing knowledge but also competing. Even when firms grew bigger, the networks remained surprisingly important. And there's an absolutely extraordinary set of parallels, I believe, between the story of Manchester between 1770 and 1828 and the story of Silicon Valley between around 1938, when Hewlett and Packard set up their little garage company in Palo Alto, and the present day. It's a continuous cascade of innovation created by individuals, but within highly networked systems of economy, as Annalee Saxenian has reminded us in her celebrated comparison of Silicon Valley and Boston's Highway 128. But as a number of commentators have emphasized, there are two models in this century of capitalism and with different attendant models of innovation. There's the Anglo-American model of bottom-up innovation, and there's a German and Japanese model of state-guided capitalism. Both have succeeded, and it is not quite clear, and it's certainly not clear to me at the end of this section of the book, whether one has the advantage on the other. Although I would say that the continuing extraordinary success of Silicon Valley in the period that I was writing the book and since I completed it would seem to suggest that maybe that model has a real advantage over the Japanese model, which I think we are seeing in the contrast between the state of the American and the Japanese economies in the last 8 years or so. I said that the innovative places could be called edge cities, not quite at the center, but neither completely off the edge. All had some previous tradition that proved critical. They certainly weren't trammeled by any old traditions, any old ways of doing things. Most had highly egalitarian social structures. They didn't have old wealth. They weren't class hidebound. They were open societies, and they welcomed new talent, including young talent. They had an ethos of self-reliance and self-achievement. They had open education systems, or at least open apprenticeship systems, with a stress on practical uses of scientific knowledge. They nearly all had recently acquired wealth in the hands of adventurous people willing to take a risk, venture capitalists, if you like. Many of the infant industries in these places started by catering for a local market whose characteristics they understood, often a market of related producers, producing a chain of networked interactions in which demand spurred producers, and they in turn spurred other producers by creating new demands. But they were also very different, these places. Berlin in 1870 does not have many obvious similarities to Detroit in 1900. One a capital city, the other a fairly modest manufacturing city overshadowed by neighbors like Chicago or New York or Boston. And others were more difficult perhaps to interpret than others. Tokyo, as I've said, not at all an edge city, although a fairly recent capital, feeling a newcomer in a comparison with ancient Kyoto. But at any rate, it offered educational pathways to people of ambition and ability. Primary invention doesn't seem to have been always crucial. These places often borrowed inventions from elsewhere. Silicon Valley initially borrowed especially from Bell Labs. And the automobile certainly wasn't invented in Detroit. It was invented in Europe, and both Germany and France in the 1890s were leading automotive producers, but what they didn't succeed in inventing was the mass production of the car for the people, and that was Ford's achievement and an American achievement. And the ability to ally technical knowledge to the demands of the marketplace was absolutely crucial. And so I think that one can say that the real clue was the ability to develop innovative networks in which demand begat supply, and supply again begat new demands, creating constant stimulus to permanent innovation. And that seems to be the model which Silicon Valley most aptly illustrates. Now, time presses on, and I want to come towards the end, but I do want to spend a moment or two on what most extraordinary forms of innovation, and it is this marriage of art and technology. It is a 20th century story. It happened especially here in the United States, and that is not surprising. As many economic historians have pointed out, America was not always outstanding in primary invention, but was unique in its capacity to turn inventions into commercially useful innovations. It very early developed traditions of mass production of standardized consumer goods for vast mass markets, the American system of manufacturing, as it was known in the 19th century. And to that it allied a populist concept of cultural entertainment far removed from the European patrician attitude that public corporations should give the masses what was good for them. And out of this came two rather extraordinary stories. The first of these, of course, was Hollywood between around 1910 and 1925, the development out of the first Nickelodeons on the East Coast especially, the first studios in New York moving to Los Angeles in around 1910, and the very rapid development there of the studio system and the feature film. Around 1913, 1914, with movies like Birth of a Nation and Intolerance, the development of the five great studios and their smaller imitations, well illustrated by the Warner Brothers here. The money came out of New York, and the creativity flourished here, often, as we all know, in bizarre forms, and with a constant tension between the two coasts, which is told in many celebrated stories. And then the other story in this section of the book, the story of the poorest region of the United States in the 1920s and 1930s, the Mississippi Delta, south of Memphis, Tennessee, a cotton-picking tradition soon to be swept away by the cotton-picking machine in the 1940s and 1950s. Out of this, the experience of the poorest people in the whole of the United States, the Afro-American cotton pickers of the Delta, and their production of blues music. On the other side of Memphis, in the hill country to the east, not far away, the development out of another extremely poor group, the Anglo-Scottish-Irish white hillbilly folk that had come across the Appalachians. This music fusing with the blues in Memphis in the early and middle 1950s, recorded for the first time at the Sun Recording Studios, and exemplified by Elvis Presley, who for the first time successfully managed to bring together these two musical streams. So what do we learn out of these two rather extraordinary American stories? What do we learn? I think that we learn that it is possible for entrepreneurs flourishing in a uniquely open society to reach new audiences. First of all, the movie moguls reaching the immigrant masses of the eastern seaboard cities. And secondly, the entrepreneurs of Memphis reaching the newly emerging black working class of the post-World War II era, and also reaching out to alienated white teenagers growing up in the new suburban America who were being ignored by the established commercial interests and constituting new markets of almost limitless potential. So new entrepreneurs who emphasize with their customers and nearly all the, interestingly, nearly all the Hollywood movie moguls were Jewish immigrants, first generation immigrants from Eastern Europe. and the Maverick record producers in Memphis were actually Southern-born, but understood their markets. They were absolutely archetypal new entrepreneurs, discovering huge markets for new products, and in fact inventing the products themselves. The movie industry was created by trial and error between The Great Train Robbery and The Birth of a Nation, and modern popular music was invented in a few short years between Presley and the Rolling Stones. The industry was market-led, but in turn led the market. I don't think it could have occurred in any other country but America, but what is puzzling, what is so far interesting, is why it should occur in two cities so far removed from the cultural center. And I think we have to say that this is a true example of where new industries are created in very borderland places indeed, and it may well be that another upstart city proves to be one of the great entrepreneurial cities of the century that's coming. I wish I had more time to talk about the fourth kind of innovation, the urban innovation, innovation that's born out of necessity as cities struggle with their own problems like water supply, waste disposal, traffic and transport, police and criminal justice, and provision for the poor and destitute. I fear that there isn't perhaps the time, and so I'm going very quickly to just give you a hint of what is in this final section of the book. Classical Rome, with the development of the enormous systems of water supply, sewage disposal, the development of great systems of popular entertainment. Come forward to Victorian England, development of an effective police system in the Metropolitan Police by Sir Robert Peel in the 1820s, the development of a rational system of criminal justice, of model prisons and model workhouses, developed first by Jeremy Bentham and carried out by faithful pupil Edwin Chadwick in his Poor Law Reforms, the brutal system, often but effective, of poor law reform in 19th century Britain, on systems very similar to the model prisons of the time. The great systems of engineering, including the great outfall sewers and the construction of the world's first underground railway here under the Victorian embankment. Onward to Haussmann's Paris, the Paris of Napoleon III, the vast reconstruction of that city in the 1850s and 1860s, culminating in the overthrow of Napoleon III in the period of the Communard in 1870. Come forward again to New York in the period 1890 to 1910, the development of a vast infrastructure of bridges and tunnels and railroad extensions, and finally the subway, which made possible the concentration of the center at the center of the new skyscrapers, a technology actually born in Chicago but rapidly and effectively imported into New York, and allowing the huge dense slums of the Lower East Side gradually to spread out into new suburbs in the 1920s and 1930s. Come forward, that's again the first subway ride in 1904 from City Hall Station. Come forward then to Los Angeles, a city again that struggled with enormous problems of bringing fresh water into a desert city. And then, even more epically, in the 1920s, had a great debate internally when it decided it was not going to be a city like New York or London or Paris or any traditional city, but was going to be the city, the spread city of the automobile. That decision was taken very deliberately, but led to epic gridlock in the city in the 1920s and the 1930s. This was the first city really to exhibit automobile gridlock, years and years before any other city, and finally solved, at least for a time, by the freeway system of the 1940s. And then onward to Stockholm in the 1950s, the model social democratic city, which created a model planned system of satellites served by its new subway system, coupled also with the reconstruction of the central city, a completely planned landscape around satellite centers such as this one here, the first at Vällingby, built in the 1950s. A landscape that now seems, strangely, if you revisit Stockholm, as I did last week, a landscape of the past, because it's now been subsumed, and that planned set of solutions no longer seems so apposite as it did. And finally, to the last case study in the book, London in the 1980s, the closure of the great port of London, the great debate on what was to happen to it, the decision by Michael Heseltine, who was the politician in charge, to create a development corporation on an American model, and the total reconstruction of those Docklands in a very short period in the middle and late 1980s, culminating in the saga of Canary Wharf at the end of, excuse me, we've lost a picture, I think, culminating in the saga of Canary Wharf at the end of the 1980s. Now, I come to the end, there it is, Canary Wharf, with Paul Reitman, the entrepreneur, the Canadian entrepreneur, who was responsible, and the bubble burst, and Canary Wharf went bankrupt, but has risen again, you might say, out of the ashes, and is now just about complete, and with it the great Docklands project is complete. Well, what you learn out of these very different studies is that cities were first out of necessity. You had to have clean water, you had to have sewers. If you had a breakdown of public order, you had to develop an effective police system and an effective poor law system. But in the 20th century, we are dealing with new kinds of problems, as seen in London Docklands, which and these problems consist in the need for cities to recreate themselves, to recreate their economies, and around new kinds of industries as the old industries and disappear. And that brings me to the great economist Joseph Schumpeter, who it was that coined the phrase creative destruction for the nature of capitalism. The capitalist economy, he said in 1942, constantly destroys old firms, old industries, old cities, even old countries, and reinvents new ones. That is its essence, and the essence is innovation expressed in entrepreneurship. For him, these two terms were the same, and they consisted in the ability to provide imaginative, innovative solutions in the context of the real economy, of real demand. And that, in many ways, is the story of all these cities in their very different ways, whatever the nature of the innovation, it was reaching out and increasingly reaching out to a market. And the story now and for the future, and this is the last picture and the last picture of the book, it's the young Bill Gates and the young Bill Allen at Lakeside High School in Seattle in 1968. The story is, of course, the informationalization of the economy, horrible word that, but I don't know a better one, and what it is going to do to our nations and cities in the course of the next half century. We all know it is beginning to happen. Some of us think that it's already well underway. I would argue that the real innovations are probably still to come, and we are at the beginning of this informational revolution, which is also a new form of cultural revolution, because new marriages of art and technology will occur, and these new marriages will produce new kinds of industries, new kinds of service industries, whole new kinds of activities on which cities will regenerate themselves and their economies. But this raises a final question, which I propose to you as a question tonight. And that is, will these new activities finally prove not to need the city at all? Will they prove to be the death of the city as we know it? That I leave as a question, and tomorrow afternoon, if you can bear to come back for another session, I will try to answer that question. Thank you very much for your attention. I think that Berkeley is in this sense. Sorry, perhaps we could repeat the question. I think that the audience hasn't heard it. We don't have a roving mic, do we?
No.
Could you just repeat it?
Could we just repeat it? John Kenneth Galbraith said that Berkeley was the most intense political and intellectual community in the world in 1968. Would I like to comment? I would say that certainly Berkeley was one of the most such communities in the world. There were a number of other places fermenting in 1968. I seem to remember Paris. And I don't think Van Wolfenstel is in the audience. He had more direct experience. But it was one of the more extraordinary. And I would say that out of this ferment came essentially the quality of the counterculture that you all know so well, that was so important in producing that critical further stage of Silicon Valley's development in the 1970s, which was so well represented by the Homebrew Club. If you look at that chapter of the book, which I found one of the most fascinating to write, that phase of the Silicon Valley story was produced to an extraordinary degree by very, very unusual people. They were really archetypal members of the counterculture. And indeed, most of them, saw the personal computer revolution as a political project. They saw it as a way of wresting the control of information away from the IBMs of this world. And in an important sense, I suppose that is how it has actually happened, although IBM certainly came back and started manufacturing PCs. It never had the same control over that industry. Ever since then, it has remained archetypally out here an industry of many new entrants. It's rather significant that Bill Gates never located here in Silicon Valley, but chose to go back to his hometown many hundred miles to the north. And there's the most extraordinary parallel between his story and Richard Arkwright, who took his cotton mills away from Lancashire and put them in a remote place. Finally, Arkwright didn't do too well, I have to say, at the end of the time. He did become a millionaire in his day, the equivalent of Bill Gates, but he couldn't compete with the networked economy of Lancashire. And maybe it will prove that Bill Gates doesn't compete with the networked economy of Silicon Valley either.
Would you care to comment on how your ideas in city relate to Ferenc Braudel's view of the cities in the evolution of capitalism?
That's a very good question, thank you. I think they follow extremely well, although I didn't myself draw on Braudel very heavily in the book. His studies are of the Mediterranean, for instance, I think very much tell the same kind of story in much greater depth. The way he understands the springs of the local economy very much embodying cultural and economic history within the same tradition, I think represents very much the same kind of approach trying to understand how the dynamics of economic history in particular come out of a really rather special sets of previous economic and thus social circumstances and in some cases also cultural circumstances also. So yes, I think there's a very close parallel there.
How central is the question of cultural conflict and exchange of individuals and ideas within cities? You mentioned trading centers. Athens, as we know, is two-thirds foreigners in Periclean times, mostly slaves, but nonetheless, maybe with some history of other places. How central is the idea of synthesis and resynthesis because of cultural interchange? You touch on it in a number of places, but I don't know that you've made it central.
I do make it central, or a central theme. There's no one central theme, but it is one of the central themes. Certainly in cultural innovation, it proves remarkable again and again and again that it was a mixture of people coming in from outside, often young, often feeling partly inside, partly outsiders, that made the real innovations. And I believe you can trace exactly similar stories in the technological innovation too. From the early people like Hargreaves, or Arkwright himself, who started life as a barber and just switched into entrepreneurship, right through the other stories such as Siemens or Ford himself, they were all really not established people. They usually weren't desperately poor, but they all were requiring to make their way in the world. They had no expectation when they were young that they were necessarily going to make it, so they were all driven to that extent. Whether they came from outside, for instance, Paul did not. He was a local boy in Detroit. Von Siemens came into Berlin. He was born outside Berlin. And in fact, he was probably the best of all because he came from a minor aristocratic family. But in general, they all felt that they had to make their way in the world. And these cities were incredibly networked places where ideas were breeding out the other ideas, and they were mainly bought by newcomers. So that's a vital ingredient. But it can occur sometimes in quite central places, and it can occur sometimes in quite peripheral places. If for some reason they're attracting large numbers of new migrants, as for instance Los Angeles was in the 1920s, 10s and 1920s, or the San Francisco Bay Area throughout the post-war 18 period. So, yes, the answer is overall yes, but the way it works out in particular cases is something different in city to city.
One last question, okay.
I have two phrases that I hang on to, and one is the prepared mind, and the other is that that all of these great flowerings have stood on the shoulders of some minority groups or slaves or whatever in order to be able to accomplish this great flowering of cities.
I don't know if everyone heard of that because it came right from the front row. Two phrases. One, that the prepared mind, and secondly, the notion that all these cities stood on the shoulders, so to speak, of oppressed groups. Well, the prepared mind is a good phrase, I think, to express many of the people, individual people, who made the innovations in these places. They were prepared by their background, they were prepared by their ambitions to do something, but they were prepared by life in the ferment of the city around them, which taught them what they needed to know and taught them through exchange with other people. Now, your second point about exploitation is very, very interesting. Most of these cities were pretty exploitative places. The Athenians depended on slaves, labour. Florence was an extraordinarily unequal society in which a very large proportion of the population was destitute, really truly destitute from time to time. And nearly all the other cases, through to even Berlin in the 1920s, most of the ordinary people lived in incredibly squalid conditions, extremely exploited, without adequate housing, often without even enough to eat. I think that that just represents the fact that that was what was like in all cities until very, very recently. It was the point that Keynes was making in 1930. I think that we, that was why I took care to make the point at the beginning. I think that what Keynes so memorably described as science and compound interest, and by science, of course, really meant innovation, have brought us in countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, now to a situation where most people do have enough to eat, and most people, not all to be sure, are decently housed. This is a remarkable achievement, I think. And it does pose new questions for our possibilities in the future. That's not to again say that there is still a huge problem out there in the cities of the developing world, which many of which have still to go through this great transition. And some, I have to say, are not showing much signs of making it. If I were to give a different lecture entirely about what's happening to cities in the world today, I'd say the good news is that large numbers of cities and their countries have had a remarkable transition in the last 30 or 40 years, coming from rock-bottom poverty to relatively considerable affluence. But there is a whole other group of cities that so far aren't making it, and that's a big question mark for me.
Listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.